pretty nice. The sun came out, huh? Yeah. Well, it's great to be here. Great to see all of you. I wish I could see you more often, but it impresses me, you know, the old saying, yet more and more I'm seeing that all of spiritual practice comes down to these old sayings, you know, that our grandmothers knew. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. I'm really seeing how true that is. It makes the fact that I don't come so often makes it even more precious. It's even nicer to see everybody. And since the truth is, these old sayings, you know, the more you think about them, the deeper they get. The truth is, absence is constant. It's even right in the middle of presence, which means that everything is precious. Every single day, every single thing, every single person. And it's particularly precious for me to be here celebrating Chris's being Chuseau. I guess the whole city of Bellingham and the Red Cedar Zen community must be having a special glow with the return of both Chris and Edie from Tassajara. They must have brought with them a little extra glow.
And Elizabeth,
that's right, I forgot. Where's Elizabeth? I forgot, you were there too, that's right. That's right. And you probably also brought a glow to Tassajara from Bellingham that they appreciated. Yeah. So that's special. And I know that Chris has been doing a great job as Chuseau. And she sent me a link to her marvelous Dharma talk, which I was able to hear online. And it was like a great novel, you know, I couldn't put it down. I thought, oh, I'll listen to a little bit of it and I'll listen to a little more later, but I was riveted. I couldn't stop until I came to the end. And I hope everybody here had a chance to hear it. One of the things that I appreciate the most about Zen practice is that although in the end you come to realize that it's a practice that's mostly about compassion, gratitude, and appreciation for each and everything. You wouldn't necessarily notice that because Zen practice is so unsentimental. And that reminded me of Chris's talk. It was very open, it was very full of emotion, but it was quite unsentimental, not at all sentimental. Because Chris is a tough cookie. She's not too sentimental. And yet at the same time, I believe that practice has helped to emphasize more and more the loving heart that has always been natural to her. Also, I feel like practice has widened her large smile a little bit more. So thanks, Chris, for being Chuseau. And I'm looking forward to your Dharma talk, which is tomorrow or today? Tomorrow, yeah. To your talk tomorrow and to your looking forward to your ceremony on Sunday. And I want to thank Tim for being Chris's Chuseau teacher. Thank you for taking care of that and doing such a great job with that, guiding her through this wonderful process. I don't know how it works, why it's so special, and why it has this transformative power, but everybody who's been through it knows it does. So I want to thank them and all of you, the old-timers who are hanging in, all these decades, giving the place a little character. And the newer people, all of you, for your devotion to practice. As the years roll by, I am more and more impressed with the depth. Please come in. Come in. With the depth and feeling of our practice. And I was thinking this morning, the depth and feeling of our practice is very impersonal. Impersonal in the sense of being kind of beyond persons, you know. Persons come and go, but the practice keeps going. It's impersonal in that sense, in the sense of being universal and all-inclusive. And how wonderful it is that each one of us, as persons, shines so brilliantly and so uniquely, you know, against this background of mysterious, universal, impersonal practice. Since we're doing a lot of sitting this weekend, I thought for today I would talk about Zazen, our sitting practice. When we enter Zazen, we're entering a whole world, a whole process. And we can no longer maintain the illusion of ourselves, the illusion that we can control our lives, we can control ourselves, we can control our world. Sit there long enough and it becomes quite clear that you don't make your life. Your life makes you. And the more you try to maintain yourselves and your own preferences, the harder Zazen gets. And the more we're willing simply to let go, simply to let the body and the life that flows through us simply flow on, just like the ocean flows on, the easier Zazen will be and the more rewarding it will be. When we feel pain in Zazen, whether it's a physical pain or a psychological or a spiritual pain, the pain we're feeling is the pain of our own self-clinging. That becomes quite clear. And yet, we all cling a lot. All of us do. That's what we do. We're human beings, and that's our human problem. So when we sit there with lots of troubles, there's no need to be frustrated or ashamed. It's just our being human. And we just keep on doing our best to go on with the practice, trusting that the process of our life itself is going to take care of us. And doing this is already doing a lot. We all notice how self-protective we are, how fearful we are. What if you really, really, really knew that you could trust your life no matter what happens? What if you knew that? What a great source of strength that would be. And also of softness, of gentleness. You wouldn't have to feel anymore like your life was a struggle. And that is the possibility and the hope of every single period of Zazen. You will do this weekend or any time for the rest of your life. So we're lucky that we've found this practice and that we have this weekend to practice it thoroughly. That we can have a place like this in which to practice it. We're really, really lucky. Anyone shows up and takes it for granted, but it's a very, very rare thing. So this is our Zen practice. This is what we're trying to grow into. Simply learning how to absolutely trust our life. And we do it by tuning our body and mind just like you tune a musical instrument, which you do by feel and by careful listening. You can learn it, but it's not a conceptual learning. You learn it by trial and error, by practice over and over again. You tighten the strings just so much. You try to get them not too tight, not too loose. Then you pluck a string and you listen. Then you adjust a little bit and pluck again. Maybe at first you can't really hear the difference between one sound and another too much because your ear isn't yet very good. But little by little by little you can hear the music. And you realize that the whole environment, the whole universe is giving you feedback. And you begin to hear it. And you begin to feel the rhythm and the flow. And you begin to see the beauty of our practice and of our human life. It's so beautiful, you know, being human together in this bright world that is made exactly for our eyes and our ears, and our eyes and our ears, and our whole body is made for it. It's very important this weekend and always to keep a continuity of practice. That means not to press really hard and then feel like you collapse and you have to take a big break. Or maybe on the other hand, not to try hard enough. That's especially dangerous for us old timers who've been doing this a long time, take it for granted maybe, not try too hard. Or maybe in the long run, not just for the weekend, but you know, in the long run, well, I don't need to sit too much. I've sat enough already. I'll sit once in a while, you know, to be with the community and maintain my high position as, you know, one of the elders so that they know I'm still around, but I won't come too often. So that happens, you know, it's natural. But the truth is, Zazen is actually a serious and a disciplined practice. It takes effort, it takes commitment. It's fun, I think. It's actually a pleasure to sit Zazen, believe it or not, it really is. Because being quiet is really nice. Just being quiet is such a pleasure. Tim was saying this last night. How nice, you know, to have a chance to just sort of set all your terrible problems down. Nothing to do about them. Just sit. It's really nice. On the other hand, many people really like excitement. That's fun too, you know. Anxiety, pressure, adrenaline. You know, it's kind of great. You know, a lot of people really like that. We have a deadline. We have to do this. We have to do that. Go for it. You know, it's exciting, and that's good too. And for sure, there's a time for that. You know, for this driving energy, this pushing. There's a time for that. But peacefulness is really nice. Peacefulness is really good. And it's also necessary. If you drive and drive and drive and drive and you don't know how to stop, it's no good for you. You can't keep it up, you know. So Zazen is a necessity and a real pleasure. And there's some playfulness to it also, some creativity to it. Once you get into it, you realize it's such a playful, creative practice. Because you never know what's going to happen next. You never know. And you have to be ready for anything. But at the same time, it's quite serious. And sometimes you have to show up, even when you don't feel like it, even when it isn't fun. It would not have been too good if I called up like yesterday and said, you know what, Tim, I'm not really feeling like this is what I want to do this weekend. I don't feel like, you know, it's kind of like there's a good ball game on. And that would not have been any good, you know? So it takes some effort. You know, you really have to have a commitment. You can't really fool around. You got to stay on the beam. You got to keep in tune and in tandem, in connection with the practice. So practice really is a rest and a break and a renewal and a refreshment. I certainly feel that. And at the same time, when you sit in Zazen, you are also truly sitting in the very midst of your deepest and most serious human problems. Much, much bigger problems than the ones you think you have. I often say at the beginning of sessions and retreats, there are no breaks. Because in life, there are no breaks. You'll get a break soon enough. But in the meantime, there are no breaks. You're going to be alive pretty much constantly until you're not. So there are no breaks in life, and there are no breaks in Zazen. Every minute, we're always alive. And that means every minute, we're always practicing. Every minute, there's body and mind. And every single minute, we have to respond to life's call. So when we're sitting, we come back to the breath moment after moment. We stop and pay attention to the body. When thoughts come, we pay attention to them too. Whose thought is this? Where is this thought coming from? Where is it going? And what world is it making for me now? Our thoughts make a world, and we live in that world. We're not trying to have answers to these questions. Our practice is not about having answers. And we're not trying to solve anything. The point is that we sit and we don't take our thinking for granted, as though our thinking were really true, as though our thinking really belonged to us. Your thinking doesn't belong to you. It really doesn't. You did not invent human thought. Your thought comes from your language. It comes from your family. It comes from the endless recesses of the human past. This thinking is something we all share. And when we think it's ours, we suffer a lot more than we have to. So in Zazen, simply by sitting there, simply by returning to the breath, simply by returning to the body, simply by making this effort to be present, we are questioning our thinking. And we are creating a new context for our thinking. We're creating a big space around our thinking. We don't just assume our thinking and assume it's real and assume it's true. We allow ourselves to experience it more fully than we usually do. And we learn how to let go of our thinking. And we use our body. And we use our breath. And we use our presence. And we use our faith. And little by little by little by little, period of zazen after period of zazen, retreat after retreat, year after year, we learn how to tune our body and mind to our true self. When the Buddha first went forth from home to seek the Dharma, he was a young man. He didn't have much suffering. In fact, he had an exceptionally blessed life, and he was much loved and admired by his family and by his community. He was a young man with lots of promise. So when all of a sudden he left home and went forth into a homeless life, it was a shock and a terrible blow to his family and his whole community. When it was noticed that the prince was gone and Chandra, his servant and chariot driver, was gone, and that the famous horse that was his horse was gone, everybody was very upset. And when Chandra came back with Kanitaka, the beautiful horse, but without the prince Siddhartha, the whole community that had been a happy place. Oops. Lunch is calling. The whole community that had been such a happy place was all of a sudden gloomy and sad. Why would such a promising young person with his whole life ahead of him do such a thing? Anyway, this is the account that you can read in Ashvaghosa's great poem, the Buddhacarita. It describes all this. Like the sun went out, you know, over this whole kingdom. Why would he do this? The Buddha saw suffering in the faces of people. He saw people bent and despondent with age and sickness. He saw the strange and disturbing spectacle of death. And he realized there is no way out. There is no possible security except in complacency and denial and avoidance. And these are not only illusions, they're dangerous. So it became absolutely impossible for the young prince to go on with life as he had known it. And I can relate to the Buddha's feeling. When I was a young boy, I could also feel the suffering. Like the Buddha's parents, my parents too tried to protect me from it and to hide it from me. But children always know. This is very frightening when you're a parent, you know. Children know everything. I was born right at the end of World War II, just when the soldiers were coming fresh home from the battles, with all the suffering that they could not speak about. And my father had been a soldier in that war, and the fathers of my friends and relatives had been soldiers. And as a Jewish child, I absolutely could feel the terror and the grief of Hitler, even though no one told me about it. They tried never to mention it. They never spoke about it. they didn't have to speak about it. Maybe it would have been better if they did, I don't know. But they thought, like most people then thought, let's not dwell on the past. Let's forget about it. Let's move forward. Don't dwell on it. Anyway, we all had to go forward, didn't we? Nowhere else ever to go but forward. And I also knew about death in my own family. And I saw how difficult death was, how confusing it was, and how frightened it left everyone, and how numb. So yes, there's always suffering, even if you yourself don't suffer. But actually, even if you don't suffer, you really do suffer when there's suffering around you. And the suffering around you is always right there in your own body. So we all try to forget, we try to move on, try to change the subject, try to think of something else. And we have to do that, of course we do. And maybe we can actually do that. Maybe we can do it enough and go forward and not dwell on it. And somehow or other, you know, we all do. If all of us paid attention to the enormous grief that this world is full of, nobody would be able to get out of bed any day. You know, we all have to get up every morning and forget about it. We have to. But in the end, there's no escape from life and time. And what life and time will inevitably bring. So what I'm saying is that whatever suffering there is in your life, it has roots in all of human life. It's not just yours. Those of us in the room here who are a little bit older have come to recognize by now, maybe with some shock, that we have been unsuccessful in the effort to escape our parents. Even though they've been dead, you know, for decades, somehow they're still talking to us. We just can't shut them up. One time, I think I mentioned this in one of my books years ago. I've always been impressed with this. It's very true. Like the psychologists were studying, like really old people in old age homes, people like 85 years of age and older. And they were studying, like, what were their concerns? What were they talking about? What was the main thing they talked about to each other? It turned out the main thing they thought about and talked about to each other was their parents. It's 85, 90 years old, and you're constantly thinking about your parents. If you're younger, you might think, well, I have escaped my parents, or I'm going to eventually escape them. And if you think like that, I really wish you best of luck. And maybe you can do it. I don't say that you can't do it. Maybe you can do it. But possibly not. Now, in saying this, I'm not saying that our parents are somehow bad influences on us. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. I don't know. But I think those of us who have had parents, pretty much all of us, I guess, and those of us who are parents, we'll have to admit that pretty much all parents are good and bad. The harder you try, you know, no matter how hard you try, you're going to be a good and a bad parent. So in other words, this is not the problem. The problem is that the past, which includes not only your parents, but all of your past, just doesn't go away. It's always with you, and you never escape. The past makes an etching in your soul, runs grooves down your brain. Maybe, you know, you think you had a bad time of it. Bad parents, bad circumstances. And maybe you did. But in the end, everybody has a bad time of it. This is one of the striking things about Chris's talk. She told us about how bad her parents were. and how good they were. And what a traumatic childhood she had, and what a wonderful childhood she had. And we're all like this. We have all been shocked to have lived the life that we have lived. If you pay attention, you're shocked. How did this happen to me? How did this happen to me? So the great problem is, how do you find your own real life in the middle of all of this? How do you find a true life? How do you find the strength? How do you find feet to stand on? So what I'm saying is that we all have suffering, and the suffering we have is not just the suffering of our own life. It's not just about what happened to us. It's about all of us, the whole human family, our endless fear of death and the unknown, and all the terrible, terrible ways that we have disrespected and hurt and oppressed one another everywhere in the world over all these generations. It is truly a tragedy. So sad and horrible, and so moving and so beautiful that human beings survive all this and do what they do and make what they make and experience the love that they experience. When you tune your mind and body in Zazen, mind, body, and heart, you feel life like that. And when you feel life like that, it makes a huge difference in the way you will live. So the point of practicing Zazen is not to make us great meditators. We don't care if we're great meditators. It's not to make us calm and peaceful. We don't care, really, whether we're calm and peaceful. It's not so that we can understand the Zen stories. Who cares, you know, whether we understand the Zen stories? It's not even so that we can understand our lives. We practice Zazen so that we can actually feel in our whole body, in our whole mind, in our whole heart, the depths of this human adventure. Feel it and be willing to completely live it with appreciation and gratitude, and side by side with others, with the people we love, which in the end includes everybody. As you all know, our particular tradition in Zen emphasizes steady, constant practice. Not, you know, tremendous intensity for 1 week or 1 month or 3 months or 3 years, but constant daily practice. Daily sitting. Sitting for a weekend once in a while. Sitting for a week once a year or more. Constant practice over time. And especially letting the sitting practice, letting our Zazen pervade our heart and our mind and our point of view all of the time. After a while, it makes no difference whether we're on the cushion or not. When we practice Zazen, not as an occasional activity or even as a religious practice, but as a way of life, we will come to feel differently about everything. This difference is subtle and takes years to ripen, but it's absolutely unmistakable. It does not solve all our life's problems. It does not make us special people in any way, but it does situate us fully and completely in this human world, to live it and to love it. I love how Tibetan Buddhism always says, everyone wants to be happy. We're all alike, you know, all human beings are exactly the same, and that we all want to be happy. They always say that, and it always cheers me up, although I'm not entirely sure it's true. I think Tibetans may not have, when they formulated that teaching, they may not have met Westerners who actually are neurotic and may actually sometimes prefer not to be happy. There are people who would, I'm stubborn, I don't care what anybody says. I just to prove those Tibetans wrong, I don't want to. So maybe they're not entirely right about that, but I think they make a good point, and they're substantially right. I mean, I myself definitely prefer happiness to misery. I would rather be happy. Probably you would too. And our path is definitely a path of happiness. But the path of happiness goes right through suffering. That's how you get the path. That's how you get to the happiness, right? You have to go through the suffering. You can't go around. You'll never get to the happiness if you try to go around the suffering. The path to happiness goes right through the suffering. The truest happiness is compassion. Compassion means to truly care for our own suffering and the suffering of others, to feel the suffering of others and our own suffering with love and with tenderness and with courage, even if we can't change things. That is happiness. And when we ourselves are suffering, we know how important it is that someone can see and feel and understand our suffering. No wall can ever be tall enough or thick enough to shut out suffering. Even though we build such walls inside and out. To build such walls and work hard to maintain them for a lifetime is truly painful. But to live in peace, with trust, on an open ground, with feet firm to stand on that ground under a blue, beautiful sky, without fear, amazed and grateful for everything you experience. Now, this is the hope and the aspiration of our Zazen practice. So I want to thank all of you for taking the time out of your busy, full lives to sit together this weekend and to come visit us for this hour. And I especially want to thank the many of you who take the responsibility to make sure that this can happen. I'm aware, very much aware, of how much work is involved here, the registration work, seeing to all the services, the setup, the cleaning, the orioki, the cooking. I know how much it takes. And I know that everyone who's doing it has plenty of other things that they have to do and take care of besides making sure that the zendo works well. So I really do appreciate it. And it is a blessing. It is an offering to the whole world. I want to thank you all very much. And in that spirit, let's continue sitting, paying attention completely, enjoying our practice. Thank you very much.